right, everyone. It's Monday, March 16th. Every day seems like a year now. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As you've come to expect, we begin every show, every day until now and the November election, assuming there is an election, with the words of Colonel Vindman as he testified before Congress. Again, he told his father, it will be all right. It was so premature, Colonel Vindman, but we love you and we admire you.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful to my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, everyone. Again, Colonel Vindman. So before we begin our show, a couple of things. Obviously, because of what's happening with COVID-19, we need to figure out how to operate differently as a radio station or a small, tiny operation. So we are beginning to figure out how to actually do our shows, do them in a timely way, but do them remotely and then be able to put them on the air on the radio and then upload them to Pacifica. So those of you that listen to us around the country and then obviously stream or podcast around the world, we think it's important that the kind of shows we do happen on a regular basis, because for us to be shuttered or to go dark doesn't help us stay connected and maybe in some ways stabilize each other. So I just want to give you an idea that we're going to be working kinks out. We're trying to figure this out on the fly. We're actually going to be taping tomorrow's show this afternoon so that we have a show that is both also timely and relevant for tomorrow. And tomorrow we're going to try to figure out what to do. But, these are what community radio stations do. They respond to the needs of the community. They figure out how to do it on a shoestring. They figure out how to be creative in ways nobody thought possible. And at the same time, what I think we need right now is kind of a sense of emotional stability and environmental stability. And I know for a number of you, hearing us on the air every day at 12 or 7 on my little radio station, or being able to podcast a show, or being in Houston and waking up early in the morning as you make your breakfast or go to work, or maybe maybe not going to work, you're used to hearing us. We want to make sure that we wake you up in the morning and that you get to hear, you know, our voices, our hysteria, our excitement, and everything else. So please forgive us as we try to figure this out, but we are going to figure it out, and we're in this together. Again, if there was ever a time that we need to let our fellow neighbors, our fellow citizens, our fellow human beings, that we have each other's back, it's now. The antidote to Donald Trump is how we behave. It's how we behave. And if we behave with understanding and kindness and compassion and exhibit patience, never has patience been so important as it will be now. I just wanted to give you an idea of what we're doing, because we really don't know yet, because we're literally figuring it out on a fly, but we will figure it out, and so will you. So those are my pearls of wisdom for today. And then, of course, Ken, what would you like to say? And then we'll go grab our guests.
I think that you said it all really about the virus and being in this together. One thing that the virus shows is that the whole planet is in this together. So,
yeah.
And people have been talking about climate change and the planet is all one. I think this virus makes it pretty clear that we're all one in a whole lot of ways.
Spaceship Earth.
Spaceship Earth, absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, Yeah.
Yeah, and it's so amazing. And, how do you social distance when you're the same spaceship? And that's what we are. We're the same spaceship.
Yeah, and some of the issues that we've been talking about with the need for people that are vying to lead our country in the elections must take into account average Americans and not just Wall Street and the stock market the way Trump seems to. The virus, again, brings that home. It's all about real human beings and real lives. And, gee, if my kids are not going to be able to go to school because they're closed, then how am I going to be able to go to work? And these are questions that average parents ask all the time, with or without a virus out there. My kid's sick. My kid's got some other issue. What do I do? And you got to take time off of work. And if you're in the weaker, the less powerful position at work, namely not the owner or the big vice president of the company, you really have to sometimes weigh whether you're willing to lose your job to be able to take care of your children because there's no paid family and medical leave. But these are the issues that some of the candidates talk about, and they're real live issues affecting right now every single one of us.
And we can't ask people to make Sophie's choice. That's really what this is.
Yeah.
What do you choose? Do you choose your job or you choose your children?
Right.
Do you choose – no, it's in a way, do you choose to pay the rent or pay the electric bill? Do you choose to feed the family? I mean, this is – in order to create stability –
divide your medicine in half
because So in order to create stability and not fear, you have to make the investments in what people crave for stability. Mm-hmm. And they crave the ability to pay bills. They crave the ability to take care of their children. They crave the ability to feel secure in their streets. This is what government's job is to do. It's not to give you a job, but it's to stabilize you when you don't have one. It's not to be able to say, you know, in a lot of ways, this is what we do together. And what we do together is govern. That's what we do together. Right. Government is a reflection of us. So if you want our government to act responsibly, one, you need to elect a responsible government. But then you have the expectation that government will, in fact, behave that way. And I think that's really what the conversation is going to be going forward and how we need to address it in 2020 as we look at the election.
Exactly. And just as we as individuals and family members try to do everything that we can to keep the family going and take responsibility and have our neighbor cover our child care if we can't, and, you know, we help each other out. The government really is the flip side of that, only for things, types of things that we can't handle as individuals or small people.
You're not on your own, Jack.
Bigger groups. Somebody has to make sure that downstream the river is clean, not just me watching out for myself.
Right. So it's going to be a challenge.
So a lot out there, and I'm going to call our guests right now.
All right. So everyone, so it's our Rethink the Week. You're not going to hear Dean Spiliotis because, again, we wanted to have as few people in studio as possible. He will probably be joining us remotely next week as we move to a more remote ability to actually put together this radio show and then put it up both on the radio and on Pacifica, as well as stream it and podcast it. So you will not hear Dean Spiliotis. You will, however, hear Russ Muirhead, the head of the government department at Dartmouth College, and Val Endres, a political communications professor at Rhode Island College. But I have a couple of asides here, everyone. And one of my asides is about Devin Nunes. He was on Fox News the other day. And he was encouraging people to dine out, even as experts were urging them to stay home. He is a California Republican who was trying to promote the economy in the face of the coronavirus pandemic. Everything the health experts were advocating, which was isolation, he was in fact saying, oh, you can get a table so easily and yada, 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 instead of maybe saying, you should isolate and I'm going to be at the forefront of the Republicans helping to make sure that we can stabilize this economy so when waiters aren't employed anymore, they will still get a paycheck. But of course, he was telling us to behave in the exact opposite way. And after listening to him and hearing what he was saying on Fox News, all I wanted to do was basically suggest, one, that he should be impeached. And Glenn Smith, one of our regular guests from Texas who ran Ann Richards' campaign, made a really interesting point that, to a large extent, Donald Trump is urging his followers to drink the Kool-Aid. That's what he's doing. He's asking them, like in Jonestown, to drink the Kool-Aid. not to listen to the scientists, not to believe in the truth, not to protect their children, not to protect their communities, to actually harm their children by ignoring what is going on, by thinking it doesn't apply to them, by thinking it's some cabal. It's some cabal. Oh, my God. Tell the Italians that. Tell the Chinese that. The numbers doubled, I think, overnight in China. I mean, actually, the numbers are going down in China. Thank God, if I believe what the government is saying. But my understanding is that the numbers are going down in China. But in Italy, they're out of control. And again, I want to remind everyone that the Italians is also, it's one of the oldest populations in all of Europe. So they have the most vulnerable population that is so susceptible to this. So it is not surprising that this would be such a difficult thing to do. But everything, life is going to change. It's going to change. It must change. And the question is, how resilient are we? And, you know, the other thing is that we've gone a little bit way too comfortable. Unlike Europe, we didn't live through World War I. We didn't live through World War II. We participated. You know, we sent our soldiers overseas. We might have had some experience in Hawaii, which brought us into World War II. But for the most part, we have been pretty lucky. This is our World War III because it is world. It is a war. It is a virus. But it doesn't matter what side of the pond you're on. It doesn't matter whether you've picked the white hats or the black hats, because we're all vulnerable to this, and we're going to have to learn to make adjustments and tighten our belts and behave differently. Unfortunately, we have a leader that doesn't have the capacity to lead. And as someone said the other day, each state and each governor is going to have to act to some extent like a president. And then maybe as they all sort of react simultaneously, it'll force the country and those around the president to embrace the idea that we have to act as a nation. Again, joining us right now for our Rethink the Week is Russ Muirhead, head of the government department at Dartmouth College, Val Endres, political communications professor at Rhode Island College. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Arnie.
Yeah, it's wonderful having both of you.
Great to be here.
So I don't know if you saw this, but there's a couple of things I wanted to talk about. Glenn Smith, who we've talked to from Texas on a regular basis, has always kept sending us things out. And he was talking a little bit about looking at the 2020 election. And we'll get into COVID and the president. But obviously, I'm also looking at what happened most immediately last night, which was Bernie and Biden. And I was unhappy, believe it or not. I, as someone said, it was almost like they debated like what happened over the course of the last 3 weeks hadn't happened. And that was, I think, unfortunate. But what Glenn Smith wrote was something that he saw from a historian, William Lichtenberg. And he was going back in history. So again, there is maybe some lessons from history. Roosevelt's campaign for president was necessarily cautious. His opponent, President Herbert Hoover, was so unpopular that FDR's main strategy was not to commit any gaffes that might take the public's attention away from Hoover's inadequacies and the nation's troubles. FDR traveled around the country, attacking Hoover and promising better days ahead, but often without referring to any specific programs or policies. Roosevelt was so genial that his prescriptions for the country so bland that some commentators questioned his capabilities and his grasp of the serious challenges confronting the U.S. The real action came after FDR got himself elected. That's a reason he may have campaigned like that. So I will start with our head of government department, Russ Muirhead. Interesting commentary. As I look with dissatisfaction to what happened last night, maybe the blandness of Biden, I think what my friend Glenn Smith was trying to do in using FDR as his explainer in chief, that maybe we should understand that perhaps Biden and his team clearly understand, but what they're doing is they're holding it in, focusing on Trump, and then you will see how changes will happen and happen in rapid succession.
It's an uplifting thought. let's hope it's true.
I
worry that Biden is a much more rigid and, let's say, fully formed, if not also tired, figure than Franklin Roosevelt was in 1929.
Right.
And I don't think that Biden's going to, you know, surprise us with layers of, you know, vigor and inspiration that he's not revealing now on the campaign trail, you know, once he's elected. It is possible, however, that though, you know, he's somewhat uninspiring, what we'll get from a Biden presidency is rather bland competence. And bland competence could be very refreshing.
So, Val, I want to challenge Russ a little bit on that. And that I know he already has said that he will pick probably a black woman. And obviously that black woman's got a lot of pressure on her right now, whoever that black woman is. And in part, maybe she will compensate for Biden bland. And that where we're seeing right now the president of the United States depending so much on his own VP to handle the COVID thing, who actually seems a little more presidential than Donald Trump himself, maybe what we will see with Biden is that his team will recognize his stability, which is to some extent is also sort of rigidness, his stability, which is already sort of cemented in the past, and understanding that what they need to help him is to give him a team, and in particular, at least maybe initially, a VP who can fill in some of those gaps that are a result of age and personality. And between Biden being perhaps more open to some stuff, which I'm hoping, and that VP being able to deliver, that maybe his approach is to offer what appears to be stability compared to the instability, and that's all that people need to make the right choice in November.
That's possible, and I wouldn't rule that out. Usually, you know, we don't have a model for incredibly strong vice presidents. And Obama certainly utilized Biden, but he wasn't the public face for the administration. And so I think people are going to have some expectations that the vice president will take a back seat. You know, who knows what will happen there. But I thought what it probably demonstrated, and I think you may be right here, is that both of the candidates lacked flexibility of the moment. And I think people were looking for them to pivot to some of the immediate issues. And that caused a lot of people, I think, to miss some of the other voices in the race.
Right.
And so I think he may soothe America's souls, since that's what he's claiming he's doing, by making sure that some of those voices are in the administration. But clearly, you know, on the other side of it, Biden is well ahead. And so people are throwing their confidence toward him.
So last night, I typed on my Facebook page, you're going to love it, Ross, right? Oy vey, two old white men. Oy vey, two old white men. That's all I kept hearing. I mean, and as I'm listening to both you and Val, I'm thinking, holy crap, what is going on here? And I had said going into this, I hope they recognize the moment. I hope they recognize the moment not only to focus on Trump, but to show where they can show their consensus, where they can show that they're willing to sort of hear and listen to each other and their plans for weaving these two sort of what really aren't opposing wings of the Democratic Party, but really complementary visions that would actually respond to the crisis at hand. People want to know what they would do. Weren't you kind of shocked last night, Russ? I wanted them to focus on, if I were president today, this is what I would see done, and talk about things which maybe wink and nod might be a way to give, you know, Donald Trump an agenda to check off, but also to say, this is what we could do, I could do as a president. This is what has been lagging. And to give people a sense that they understood the leadership moment. They weren't looking for policy. They were looking for leadership, Russ.
Mm-hmm. And that they understood the weekend. I mean, this was an extraordinary weekend in the United States of America. Everyone around the country reoriented themselves as we learned more about the threat in front of us and about what's necessary to meet it. It was as if Biden and Bernie just didn't know what had happened on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I mean, Saturday morning, my son went off to play basketball with a bunch of 12-year-olds, and by the end of the day on Sunday, no one was letting, you know, anyone into their homes except for their immediate family members, and kids weren't going off and, you know, packed minivans to basketball games.
Right.
Public schools canceled from coast to coast.
Right.
So by the time that debate started, I think all of us were you know, around the country, were really quite quietly alarmed. And it was a chance for either one of those candidates, yes, to speak to the moment. And it was as if they were in a bubble and didn't know what had happened over the weekend.
Well, you know, what I want to just make a comment, though, before, because, Val, you mentioned that vice presidents actually have always not really had a significant role. I'm going to disabuse you of that. May I introduce you to Dick Cheney?
Yeah.
No. You know I'm dead serious.
And you're right.
I'm absolutely right. So I want people to know it's been done before. I mean, it got us into war. It got us into, like, you know, I mean, so it is not uncommon for that to happen. And to a large extent, I'm going to suggest, Val, that Biden, almost by his kind of old persona, is almost easily could be overwhelmed by just someone with a personality and a pulse. So to a large extent, who he chooses, or even what I would hope, is that he would choose a team and let us know of that team before he goes into November, because I think that team will be important. Someone said the other day, you know what Biden needs? He doesn't need Bernie. He needs a variation on AOC, or he needs a version on Katie Porter, you know, because you put those two women in a room and holy moly. You kind of roll. I mean, it's a different kind of brilliance. One's a more street brilliance. One's an economically sophisticated brilliance. One understands a little bit how to sort of pivot with elbows. The other one knows how to pivot with charts. But what they do is they complete everything Biden is not.
Yes. And it depends on whether he chooses his vice president as a public face, and much symbolically, like Walter Mondale did with Geraldine Ferraro, or whether he's going to revise the presidency and have a partnership, or whether, if you're talking about Dick Cheney, that this person is working behind the scenes. And if they work behind the scenes, then you need somebody like an LBJ who can count votes and who understands how to get legislation through and everything else. But I do agree with you that we need somebody who's an empathizer in chief,
yes,
that can calm the fears. We're in this for the long run.
Yes.
And we need somebody who can be the voice and be an articulate voice, something that we don't have in the Trump administration, and can tell people what to do. And I completely agree with what Russ said. In a matter of 12 hours, our lives changed, and neither one of those candidates even acknowledged the fear, the worry, the financial worries. Is my insurance going to be there? What do I do if I get sick? The list goes on and on.
Yeah.
Could I just throw out one other alternative? But, you know, you're talking about the vice president being the person who would fill one of these gaps in Biden's toolkit. But if you think about Ronald Reagan, he had a group of handlers who basically were the ones who ran his presidency. It wasn't his vice president so much, at least I don't think so, George Bush, but there was a team of people who clearly made the government run, and Reagan was more the talking head, the spokesperson.
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons I was talking about the fact that he could actually identify some of the people in the administration. But I want to go to something else, because you mentioned this, Val and Russ. So I've been thinking a lot about what you do to stabilize the economy, and we're going to be talking with a professor of economics tomorrow from Grinnell College a little bit about what's left in our economic toolbox. But one of the things I think that's so fascinating is suddenly Andrew Yang is just jumping in my head over and over again with its. But let me tell you why. You're talking to Arne Arnesen. Arne Arnesen is in the gig economy. That means Arne Arnesen would never collect an unemployment check. Arne Arnesen will never be seen on any real statistic. But Arne Arnesen still needs to pay her bills. So when all her rental income disappears, when her Airbnb disappears, she doesn't have the money necessarily to pay her bills. But, you know, if you're going to give me unemployment, I'm never going to see it. If you're going to, you know, somehow give me and the idea of the $1,000 means it doesn't look at your quote unquote employment status as we define employment status. It looks at how we've transformed the economy. So many of us don't actually fit in because we're not on anyone's payroll. And I think that's also recognizing the insecurity of this economic system that we have set up in America that so many of us have sort of disappeared from view. Russ?
Yeah, the whole employment relationship is just, you know, not like what it used to be.
Exactly.
And packing benefits onto jobs, assuming that, you know, jobs are things that are situated in inside of huge firms,
yes,
is, you know, so 1950, and it's totally irrelevant to many, many workers today.
Yes.
So right on. I mean, you know, to really release the productive potential, the innovative potential of our citizens, we need to assure them that their health care will be taken care of regardless.
Well, I don't even mean it. But here's my point to both of you, and then we have to go to a quick break. And that is, Val and Russ, what I'm thinking about is, at least initially, this could be sort of, this is the workout $1,000. This may not be a permanent plan forever. But the idea is, initially, while we get to this pandemic, rather than sort of focusing on this benefit and that benefit and this benefit and that benefit, if everyone got the $1,000, then we won't have to worry about sort of calculating what people's unemployment is, yada, yada. And you've done it.
Yeah, it's a great idea. Print money and give it to people.
Well,
and that will actually jumpstart the economy. It's a shame they were running a $1 trillion deficit in a moment of zero unemployment and, you know, economic prosperity.
And I don't disagree with you, but we're going to be printing money anyway. The question is, where is it going? And if we're going to
with you. Yeah, I think it's a good idea.
And the other thing is that I think it also then highlights what you just said, which is, why are we relating a job to whether you go to a doctor? Why are we creating a job as if the 1950s model with the gold watch after 50 years was still even relevant in today's economy? Because it's not. We've kind of moved on. All right, ladies and gentlemen, please stay right there. We have to go to a break. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Stick around.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1911. That was the day Big Bill Haywood of the Industrial Workers of the World gave his speech on the general strike. He presented it in New York City at a fundraiser for the Bucafori Defense Fund. Vincent Bucafori was a shop representative for his union. He faced repeated harassment and discharge by his foreman for executing his union duties. Finally, as witnesses described, the foreman fired Bucafori and punched him, drawing blood. Then he came at Bucafori with a heavy object. Bucafori shot and killed him in self-defense. He was charged with manslaughter, convicted, and sentenced to 10 years at Sing Sing Prison. The IWW raised money for his defense and fought for his acquittal and release. Haywood arrived at the fundraiser to deliver the keynote speech titled The General Strike. In it, he reviewed the rich history of workers' actions since the days of the Paris Commune in 1871. He also raged against electoral reform. He stated, quote, "The broadest interpretation of political power comes through the industrial organization. It gives the vote to women. It re-enfranchises the black man and places the ballot in the hands of every boy and girl employed in a shop. Makes them eligible to take part in the general strike. Makes them eligible to legislate for themselves where they are most interested in changing conditions, namely in the place where they work." He continued, quote, "You have all the industries in your hands at the present time. There is justification for political action, and that is to control the forces of the capitalists that they use against us. That is the reason that you should fully understand the power of the ballot." Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us at Labor History in Two.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Studies show that people are happier, healthier, and more productive when they spend time in buildings that include elements of nature.
There are lots of different ways we can bring nature into the built environment. People think it just means bringing plants in there, but it could also be bringing water and daylight and natural breezes, the use of natural materials.
Bill Browning is a partner at Terrapin Bright Green, a sustainable building design firm. He says many of these features are also good for the climate. For example, when designing a building with nature in mind,
I'm really going to emphasize daylighting, where I can, natural ventilation, both of which dramatically lower the energy use of the building if done well.
Browning says design can also make people more aware of local ecology. For example, his firm often uses reclaimed wood or rough-hewn stone that reflects a building's location. And carefully placed windows can encourage people to observe the changing seasons or butterflies visiting a pollinator garden.
So bringing these experiences of nature and tying you to those experiences of nature in the built environment hopefully helps you think differently about where you are.
And more connected to the environment outside your four walls. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I liked in the beginning, every breath you take. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Who sings that?
That is The Police with the great Sting as the lead singer. And it's not just taking on new meaning in terms
of, gee,
watch everybody's breath. Oops, did that person cough?
Yeah, exactly.
But also, you know, some of the health officials are talking about surveillance equipment that tracks where everybody goes and who they are interacting with.
You mean China? You mean what they're doing in China right now?
Well, yeah. But I mean, that's a health protection technique, but it's also Big Brother watching you every step you take.
Exactly. Joining us right now is Russ Muirhead, head of the government department at Dartmouth College. Your comment before about the last 12 hours, you know, from Sunday morning to Sunday night. Oh, my God, you're so right. The change is just happening at a galloping speed. Val Endres is a political communications professor at Rhode Island College. So there's been a lot of talk about, Donald Trump's looking for someone to blame, Donald Trump not taking any responsibility, Donald Trump basically, you know, the scientists say one thing, he says another, so we now just basically have to discount him. So I have two questions for you, and I'm going to start with you, Russ. When does his base recognize that he's basically offering them the Kool-Aid, that he's encouraging them to drink it? Because what they are doing, which my good friend Glenn Smith from Texas pointed out on Twitter the other day, is that basically that is what he's doing, that he's creating this idea that these people can, you know, ignore it because it's not going to happen to them, that it's not going to happen to their families, that they are now going to harm their communities, and that they are buying the misinformation coming out of him and Fox News. And this information now is deadly. And I'm just trying to figure out, does it take maybe a third of them to come down with COVID-19, a third of them to lose their parents, a third of them? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, when do they suddenly have a come to Jesus moment on this, that the man that they have so basically walked off a cliff for has basically pushed them off the cliff?
Yeah, as I understand it, I hate to say it like this, but my understanding of what our public policy essentially is right now is that this virus is going to work its way through nearly the entire population. Mm-hmm. And the goal is to slow the rate of transmission such that the number of acute cases can be handled by the healthcare system.
Mm-hmm.
There may be, you know, once the whole population acquires herd immunity, maybe 9, 10%, 15% are never infected. That's my understanding. Maybe we'll get a vaccine sooner than that, before it works its way through the whole population. But nobody's betting on that. That means that, of course, all of his supporters will become infected, alas,
exactly,
as will all the rest of us.
Exactly.
And And all of us, they, us, we, are going to be looking to our leaders for real information, information based in facts and evidence, and we're going to desperately need it in order to orient ourselves and muster the kind of intelligence and courage and even love that we're going to need to get through this. Right. And the usual scapegoating that defines President Trump's, you know, sort of rhetoric is not going to provide the resources that this country needs. So I do think that, you know, his supporters, those who don't support him that much but who voted for him anyway, those who oppose him, all of us, I think, are going to find him wanting.
Well, and I think the other thing is, and Fox News, I can we pull their license? I'm looking at the kind of information that they're spreading, and the bully pulpit valve that they're giving to people like Nunes, and all these things, and they are. I said at the beginning of the show, Nunes should be impeached for the kinds of things that he's saying, impeached and removed. This is about killing people, and that's the other thing is that this isn't about them living in a discreet place where they can believe Donald Trump and believe Fox News and believe Nunes and not impact me. Now, by what they are buying into, now by what they're believing, now what Nunes is massaging, doesn't just hurt them. They are now hurting all of us. Yes. And that the level of immorality to me is just so shocking. And I'm just trying to figure out what you do to force Fox News to stop putting out not only misinformation, but let's call it what it is. It's killing information.
You know, my sister told me a really interesting story that was quite chilling to me about her shopping experience. She had gone originally shopping. She lives in Washington State, which is ground zero.
Right.
And she went to a grocery store that was closer to Seattle, and the shelves were bare, just like they are all the way through New England. And toilet paper, canned goods, produce, you know, there's nothing left. And she lives in a very small, very conservative town that's a lumbering community. And she went to the grocery store there, and she said it was like life hadn't changed. The shelves were fully stocked, and it was normal. There weren't people milling around. And that what that said to her is that the people in her town aren't paying attention, that they are the ones who are watching Donald Trump or watching Fox News, and still Fox News with Kevin Nunes is absolutely still calling this a hoax, that somehow the Democrats are responsible for this, that it can't be true, and they're listening, and so she worried about her family in the middle of a town for people who are not taking any precautions whatsoever.
So Russ, as you hear what she just said, and I've heard variations on that theme, I posted when I sent out our conversation for today a tweet that came out of a report. And the tweet was just really interesting, and it really goes to the fact that there are still these incredibly sharp camps in America where I think 70% think it's going to get worse, but 30 to 40% think it's not. Well, that you know who the 30 to 40% are, and it's probably not people who actually believe the science. It's probably his supporters. So in the graph, it showed something unbelievably fascinating. It's real-time evidence of flattening the curve. Everyone keeps talking about flattening the curve because we can't overwhelm our hospitals. Lodi in Italy had the first COVID-19 case in Italy. They implemented a shutdown on February 23rd. They shut down the entire province. Bergamo waited until March 8th. Everyone, if you go to my Facebook page, you will see the amazing graph of what, you know, about a week and a half, 2 weeks difference was in the number of cases and how one was able to acutely change the curve and the other was so, by its just 2 week delay, was now overwhelmed. And as I'm looking at this, I believe that every governor, assuming that they have the responsibility because the president doesn't exercise, should shut down everything for at least 2 weeks. My problem is, as we have this divided information coming out of Fox News and the president, and then the rest of the media, and I don't know whoever is left, Dr. Fauci, how do you allow a country to have a shutdown when you still have this huge pocket of people that are being misled and misinformed, and the leader of that misinformation is the president of the United States?
Right. By the time it's by the time reality refutes it, it's a bit too late to engage in the kind of behavior that, that might have saved a lot of lives.
Right.
And I do think that even his supporter, the understanding of why, of just how dangerous this virus is, will penetrate the entire country, just as it did over the weekend. You know, even persuade de Blasio in New York City that he should shut down the public schools. I you know, just wrote a book about how Trump engages in conspiratorial allegations to kind of reshape all facts that he doesn't like and turn them into something else, turn them into the nefarious doings of the Chinese, you know, a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese, the Democratic Party, which is exactly what he called this virus when it first appeared.
Foreign virus.
And this is one case where I think, you know, God is going to, the reality of things is going to prevail.
Yeah, I didn't realize that the virus had a passport that said China stamped on it. You know, it's kind of like you in a way.
Wish it were a hoax.
Yeah, wish it were exactly. Wish it were a hoax. It's kind of so as
Can
I'm
just add something
going,
that I find interesting anyway. Devin Nunes' conversation reminds me of shouting fire in a crowded theater. On the one hand, Fox News conspiracy theories yak about craziness, whatever, whatever. First Amendment rights, everybody can say what they believe, but this is literally like shouting fire in a crowded theater, which causes a stampede of people and people get hurt. This is Devin Nunes is basically saying, go out to restaurants, go out to bars, infect everybody.
Well, so Val, as I'm listening to Ken, I'm thinking, but look at the courts that have been the new justices that have been appointed by President Trump. Unfortunately, what I would do is I would almost take him to court. I would take Fox News to court, but I'm not sure what court I would go to anymore. I mean, it's in a lot of ways, even our judiciary has been gutted by this president. We know the Supremes have now postponed oral arguments. I mean, it feels like all the wheels, Val, are falling off simultaneously. You know, the growing inequality that people like myself have been talking about for decades, now it's going to make this coronavirus even worse than it was whether we you know, before we had it. All these things that, you know, people who have been so wedded to debt in order to pay their bills don't have a cushion in order to survive this. I feel like everything is happening simultaneously, and that's part of the problem. We are the richest country, and I think we will become third world faster than anyone else because there is no stability built into the system to sustain anything in a way of a shock.
And ironically, it's not just the 1% of the Trump supporters. It's the people in the lower income brackets or without income at all who are also Trump supporters. Mm-hmm. And I circle back to that notion that we need some kind of guaranteed income. And black leaders throughout the nation have been talking about this weekend, how important this is to the underserved in our country. And, you know, to me, Trump eventually will have to get around to some of these policies, but if you think about it, and again, this is a Democratic ideal and not necessarily a Republican ideal, but big government can work for us. And giving everyone a guaranteed income through this crisis is demonstration that the government can do good for people. And I think that also includes Trump supporters. They can choose to accept it or not accept
it.
But, you know, I read an article last night that talked about just one person who wasn't obeying some of the recommendations who had COVID-19 in South Korea, defied orders and walked around and had infected hundreds of people, and their numbers spiked overnight in something that they were able to have one of the better programs for keeping it under control. And now we have 30% of our population who's ignoring this, and I'm sure they've noticed that their children aren't in school, but I've already, you know, we're seeing this in Rhode Island that people are, you know, still wanting to go out to restaurants and bars, and the governors have, in both Massachusetts and Rhode Island, have closed those down. They've closed down the mall to try to control the people who essentially don't believe what you know the health officials are saying.
So Russ, I've been concerned about two populations that we really talk about, and I've been talking about this ad nauseum, and that is what's happening in our prisons, which we already know that we warehouse more prisons, Russ, than any other country in the world. We also know that in a lot of situations, those prisons are already packed to the gills, where they should be only holding 100 people, they're holding 200. Where they should only be holding 700, they're holding 1,000. So we already know that they're unstable to start. They're overwhelmed to start. They've never been good with medical care. And frankly, if I were a prison guard, knowing that there's this pandemic, I wouldn't want to go to work. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. Yeah. So there's then a lot of people are in the prison system that probably shouldn't be there anyway. So it's an opportunity for us to think very quickly about this. But then let's also think about what's happened on the border. And then with the number of people that we are now warehouse in a kind of a faux prison. The detention centers are prisons. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's be honest. We have that setting as well. And then we have prisons without walls. And what am I referring to? I'm referring to the 11 million undocumented immigrants. And they're here. And they're everywhere. And they can't collect Medicaid. And they're not going to probably even get the $1,000. And they're not sure they're going to be able to get the test. So we have these really interesting pockets. If Val is talking about one person walking around in South Korea, we have the potential of millions. So I guess my question to you is, who's able to talk about that and offer a solution, again, recognizing that with these millions of weak links, all it does is create greater instability.
What a great question. I mean, it takes us back a little bit to the opening of the show and the disappointment that we felt watching the debate.
Yes.
Mm. This is a chance for both Bernie and Biden, quite apart from the race between them, to just demonstrate the kind of leadership that we're not getting from the White House,
right,
to show us about the kinds of things that they would emphasize if they were president right now. And to enact the kind of leadership that they think the country needs and that they can offer. And I really think they'd be in a very, very powerful position to broadcast the kinds of concerns about prisoners and other detained people that you just voiced. And they could make it a national issue overnight. Short of that, mm-hmm. it's going to take governors.
It is.
The governors actually have the power to do something about it. And this is an opportunity for Democratic governors in particular mm-hmm.
Let me just stop you.
A humanitarian issue.
I totally agree with you, and you're right. My disappointment after last night, I can't even tell you how I went nuts. You can sort of see. I sent you an email. I was absolutely nuts. And the reason I mentioned the prisons and the detention camps, and I mentioned the 11 million, is that I know about DACA. I know about immigration reform. I get that. But again, I want to remind everyone, that is a policy conversation. We need a solution now. We need an answer now. It may bleed into a policy conversation in the future, but those two men could not get out of their rut. That's where they were old. They weren't just old in age.
Right.
They were old in an inability to pivot and respond. And I was just appalled.
You know, Arnie, one thing that if you think creatively that the Democratic Party could do is bring back the major contenders, and that goes beyond Bernie and Biden, and look at Kamala Harris, look at Cory Booker, look at Amy Klobuchar.
Liz
Warren, certainly. Bring them together in the debate-style format and talk about action that they're calling for the COVID virus. And because many of them are in Congress or in the Senate, and at least would start a national conversation about policies.
I got it.
And you would have to cede both Bernie and Biden would have to cede, you know, power over the primaries in order to do it. But what a great selfless act for both of those men.
Can you wait, Russ? Can you imagine? I love it, Val. Listen to this. Why don't we have the focus group? So what we do is, I mean, you can almost call it that and call it a focus group, Russ, and then sort of bring them in so that people can hear the conversation. Like the question I just asked you, you know, that I posed to you about the prisoners and about the detention centers. And that is brought up in the focus group. And you can hear people talking about why this presents a vulnerability to us as a society. What are the possible ways of addressing it? And it would be that and this really becomes a democratic response. Not a Biden or Bernie response. And you get to feel like all of us have buy-in because a lot of our candidates that dropped out are there. But more importantly, it shows the bench. It shows the bench of ideas. And it shows, oh, my God, you're brilliant. Russ, you're at Dartmouth. Move that up the frickin' food chain. I don't know what you can do. But no, I'm dead serious.
What he can do is he can invite them all up to Dartmouth for this focused conversation.
Right. Maybe you should do that, Russ, because I just think that what was missing last night doesn't have to be a permanent loss. It doesn't have to be a permanent loss. And because we're in this together, this is another way of threading. Remember the Velcro that we need so much as a society, but the party needs. That would be a way to address it. And I think it's so important that we do that and do that now. Russ?
And another great figure in the party, of course, is the Speaker of the House. Jeff Tulis down at the University of Texas at Austin has suggested that Speaker Pelosi start having press conferences. On the model that used to govern presidents, since the president isn't doing that anymore, formal press conferences. And her authority and her moral authority and her command in the country and especially in the party is at a zenith. She's the only person in the country who's managed to go head-to-head with Donald Trump and never get burned. And she's widely respected. So she's somebody I think who could give that kind of issue, especially you know where there's no power, no constituency behind prisoners and the threats that they face. Somebody like Pelosi, who isn't worried about holding onto her seat, could give voice to that.
Well, and the other thing is, you mentioned the governors. So let me just end with this. So I cover Texas because we are on a big station in Houston, and I've learned a lot from one of our guests, Scott Braddock. But what I've learned is Texas is the size of a country. Texas is one of the richest economies in the United States. And you begin to notice something really frightening, except for maybe Governor Hogan of Maryland. Republican governors are responding differently than Democratic governors.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an even greater fear. Because we're talking about governors like Governor Abbott. Okay? Governor Abbott knows that Texas didn't expand Medicaid. Governor Abbott knows that the highest number of uninsured in America is the state of Texas. Governor Abbott knows how many millions of undocumented immigrants live in his state. 600,000 in Houston alone. And yet there has been sort of crickets from Governor Abbott, for the most part, on many of the things that he should be responding to. So again, one of the big problems I have is this is what Donald Trump has done. He's poisoned the Republican governor well as well. It's not just about what governors can do. Look at how some of these governors are responding, Russ.
Mm. Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing the influence that Trump has had down the ranks of the Republican Party and the way he's really corrupted it. And it is the case that if he loses his hold on his base, that will really free up lower-level Republican officials to begin to part ways from him. And that might be the beginning of a new Republican Party. And listen, this country needs a decent Republican Party.
Well, and the reason why they do is I don't want to be the Republican Party. I don't want the Democratic Party to be the Republican Party of the past, which is what they say.
That's right.
And let me just say, you know that, Val. You watch MSNBC. Half of MSNBC's hosts are former Republicans who were the political communications person for George Bush.
Well, or
were
there's a real problem with the big tent, and we see that in Rhode Island, is once you join the big tent, then action becomes just as contentious as it is between two parties.
But there's a difference between a big tent tent and the only tent. And
that's
the only
right.
tent. I don't want to be the only. I love you, Russ. I love you, Val. Please join
love
us again.
Love you too, Arnie. Thank you.
All right. Make sure that this Zoom idea that we have so we can do the show remote will continue to work so we continue to have these conversations. And Russ, think about this. Get Nancy Pelosi. You're absolutely right, to the press conferences. But think about inviting them. Have the focus group. Bring them together. Put it on so that everyone can watch it from C-SPAN to CNN. And let us hear these ideas and these questions as we debate them in a setting that they won't be debated, where we can all understand the nuances of the conversation. These aren't yes and no's. They take time. Trust me, I would tune in. I think millions would. Anyway, on that note, thank you very much. Bye-bye. And we end with
Teach Your Children by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And I picked that for, obviously, the schools are closed and we're concerned about our children and how we talk to them about this crisis, what it means, maybe what government can do to help us. But also, this is a good teaching moment.
The
having this crisis
moment.
Is a good teaching moment teachable for all
moment.
Of us.
You are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh. That your elders grew by, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well,